From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 70 of Little Brother for the 29th of January, 2022. Stay tuned, Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. So, let's get started! Same origin policy is a foundational security concept for the web. The idea is that any script loaded as part of a website should have no ability at all to interact with content or scripts from another website. This prevents a malicious actor from even knowing what other tabs you have open, never mind doing things like harvesting your cookies from another site or similar. It's the duty of your web browser, Firefox, Edge, Safari, Chrome, etc., to enforce this policy on your behalf. Unfortunately, due to a bug in Safari and iOS, owners of iPhones and iPads have had an exposure that would allow malicious actors to violate this policy, as the browser has not been enforcing it since the September release. Unfortunately, Apple have not released a patch for this security hole, so my usual advice would do no good here. Just maybe don't browse from your iPhone or iPad until this is fixed. Last week, I mentioned that the IRS is soon to be using ID.me for authentication, requiring anyone who wishes to access their tax accounts online to livestream themselves to ID.me for validation of their identity. Last week, the company stated that their identity verification service works by only attempting to determine if the face of the person streaming at them matches the face on file of that person, and that they did not make any attempt to match the face to any other persons. Well, on Wednesday, ID.me's CEO Blake Hall posted a message to LinkedIn walking back that message. In the post, Hall explains that the technology is used to try to determine the identities of recurrent identity thieves. For example, he says, Eric Jaklich of New Jersey had used stolen personal data to register more than 300 different devices and phone numbers in the names of other people. He also had counterfeit and stolen identity documents that represented the identity of his victims. In this situation, when a criminal has stolen personal data, a phone and photo government ID that represents his victim, the selfie check is the only step capable of protecting these individuals. RM Cybernetics, a manufacturer of custom electronic and cybernetic devices, recently purchased a small pick-and-place machine for prototyping and short-run device manufacturing. For those unfamiliar with pick-and-place machines, these devices are to electronics what a 3D printer is to plastics. It automates the process of piecing together a circuit by pulling electronic components from stock and putting them into place on a circuit board. Very handy thing to have if you are building electronics. However, this pick-and-place machine came with an unexpected extra feature. When the engineers at RM Cybernetics backed up the machine's onboard computer to a thumb drive, then later plugged that thumb drive into a workstation, the workstation's antivirus found that the main program that made the machine run was infected. When they submitted it to VirusTotal, the response was that 53 out of 69 different AV products identified the file as malware. The manufacturer of the machine have advised them to ignore it as a false positive. There's been a bit of chatter this week about a vulnerability in the Pulkit package on Linux, specifically one executable called pkexec. pkexec allows non-root users to run programs with limited permissions as root or as any other user in the system, given that permissions have been granted to do so, in a manner that's kind of similar to sudo, but more fine-grained. Naturally, pkexec runs as root so that it can assign processes to any user. Well, it has an overflow vulnerability that makes it possible for a user who is normally logged into a system via console or terminal session to escalate their privileges beyond what they should have, up to and including root. A patch for this vulnerability has been released, so you all know what to do. Patch your systems! And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. On Thursday, the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, voted unanimously to approve a plan for quick fact labels for broadband service. This would be something akin to the nutrition facts box found on foods in the grocery store, the lighting facts box found on packages of light bulbs, and the credit facts box found on credit card and loan offers, the goal of which is to present a quick reference to the quality and characteristics of the product. The labels that will be required by the FCC will lay out the speed, data caps, pricing, including how long any introductory offer might be, and what the prices is expected to be after the offer runs out, and any network management practices, such as throttling. All of this information is required to be available at the point of sale so that customers have the ability to compare offerings from different providers. Now, if we could just get the rest of the country to the point where there are different providers. And you know what that music means. It's time for another round of Who Got Pwned This Week. This week we have Belarusian Railways. The state-run railway of Belarus was hacked by a politically motivated threat actor. A group calling themselves the Belarusian Cyber Partisans have claimed responsibility for the hack. In a tweet last week, they stated, quote, "At the command of terrorist Lukashenko, hashtag Belarusian Railway allows the occupying troops to enter our land. We encrypted some of BR's servers, datasets, and workstations to disrupt its operations. Automation and security systems were not affected to avoid emergency situations," end quote. A follow-up tweet stated a set of conditions for the release of keys, a release of some political prisoners, and Belarus taking a stand against Russia's buildup of troops in Belarus on the Ukrainian border. As the tensions continue between Russia and Ukraine, I believe we can expect more of this, but most importantly to us in the first world, I think that we need to realize that because we have allied ourselves with Ukraine, we should expect an increase in cyber attacks coming from second world nations, especially Russia. The other notable pwn this week is the far-right nationalist group Patriot Front. The leftist media organization Unicorn Riot have published over 400 gigabytes of data collected from the right-wing group, consisting of unedited videos, chat messages, and other communications lifted from the Patriot Front servers. The leak makes clear the beliefs, intentions, and plans of the group. Unicorn Riot have not revealed the means used to acquire the data. However, distribution is happening, as is so often the case with political leaks, via BitTorrent, courtesy of distributed denial of secrets. Magnet links can be found in the usual places. It's been a busy week for Google this week. By Tuesday, I already had four headline items about them, so I figured let's just put them all together. Let's start with G Suite. When you create an account with Google, you can set it up either as a paid account for $6 a month, or you can get a free account for, well, free. These accounts use your email address as the account identifier, and for a long time, Google really didn't care where that email is hosted. Somewhere along the line recently, though, they changed this. Paid accounts can continue to use any email they want, but free accounts now have to use Gmail as the email host. On the face of it, that seems like it's not a big deal, and indeed it shouldn't be. If you've got a free account and it uses a non-Gmail email address, well, just change it, right? Yeah, not so much. Apparently you can't do that. But again, what's the big deal? Well, the answer is that many folks, especially those who own Android devices, have Google accounts for managing their music, their apps, their videos, etc., some of which they may have had to pay money for. They call it buying, but I'm hesitant to use the word here. So, now you're faced with a choice. Either you can convert your account to a paid account so that you can continue to use it, or you can abandon it, thus walking away from anything that you so-called bought. The so-called purchases aren't transferable, further making the case that they aren't actually purchases, so you can't just simply create a new account and move on from there. This is, of course, a classic problem with quote-unquote purchasing online goods. These goods may be dependent on a service, and that service may have a price or terms of use that change unexpectedly, or the service may even flat out just terminate, leaving you without access to what you paid for. Granted, the $6 a month is not an oppressive fee in this particular case, but Google have demonstrated who actually owns the things that you so-called bought. And this is not the first time this kind of issue has arisen, and it's far from likely to be the last. For what it's worth, a Pennsylvania law firm is nosing around the possibility of setting up a class action lawsuit, characterizing this as a bait and switch, and using prior cases of similar behavior from other companies, including, for instance, Nintendo, as a basis. So, what else is Google getting sued for? Well, the District of Columbia and three states are collectively suing Google for how they track users' location data. The lawsuit states that, quote, since at least 2014, Google has deceived customers regarding how their location is tracked and used by the company and consumers' ability to protect their privacy by stopping this tracking. Google leads consumers to believe that consumers are in control of whether Google collects and retains information about their location and how that information is used. In reality, consumers who use Google products cannot prevent Google from collecting, storing, and profiting from their location, end quote. The chief complaint concerns what I've heard some user experience experts refer to as a user-hostile interface. This would be the sort of user interface that deliberately steers you to a particular outcome while making a more desirable outcome technically possible, but difficult to achieve. They state that enabling location data here and disabling it there involves navigating through a complex maze of options, and that the outcome that results is not always what the user might be led to believe that it is. Google, of course, denies the claim, saying that the assertions about the settings in Android are outdated. Meanwhile, in Arizona, there's an ongoing case against Google claiming fraud. It's been going on for a couple of years now and asserts that Google's data collection practices violate the state's Consumer Fraud Act in the way it collects location data and is seeking tens of millions of dollars in fines and restitution. The claim of fraud stems from the same basic line of thinking as the last case that I was talking about, in that apparently the off setting for location data doesn't necessarily always mean off. The news in this case is that Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich has asked the court for a partial summary judgment in the case, and the request has been denied. So this one's going to carry on for a bit longer. It's probably worth noting that all cell phones, even going back to the fully analog 1G phones of the 80s, leak your location. The cellular networks, in order to be able to do what they do, have to have at least a rough idea of your location in order to bring your calls to you. There is no escaping this reality. What has changed is that starting with late 2G phones, the location was fine-tuned with GPS data, and ever since smartphones appeared, apps have been in a position to harvest that location data, sometimes for good purposes, other times just to be nosy. Okay, sidebar over. How about an item where Google isn't being sued by someone? Since a bit under a year ago, Google has been testing a technology called Federated Learning of Cohorts, or FLoC, as an alternative to using cookies to track users. They've been testing it as part of the Chrome browser since then. However, all of the other Chromium-based browsers, which is pretty much every contemporary browser except Firefox, has declined to adopt the technology. FLoC assigns users a cohort ID using the SIMHASH algorithm. Unlike other hashes, SIMHASH can be used to determine the degree of similarity between sets of data points, and the cohort ID identifies users into similar groups based on browsing behavior in much the same way as they could have been grouped by following the trail of cookie crumbs. The response was swift. Privacy-oriented search engine DuckDuckGo made a statement in April advising people not to use the Chrome web browser and observing that users would be included in FLoC whether they had given consent or not, or for that matter, without there even being a means to withdraw consent. The statement went on to say that Google should make this feature explicitly opt-in. So here we are, 10 months later. Google's changing their plans. Based on the complaints that the technology wouldn't respect the privacy of Google's users, they are withdrawing their plans to use it. Despite the privacy claims from Google, Google have determined that FLoC leaks too much information about the user to definitively protect the user's privacy. That ought to do it, don't you think? You think we need one more? You think we need one more? All right, we'll do one more. And this one is also the fail of the week, so let's cue space reggae. Like many tech giants, Google has mechanisms in place to search for copyright violations. If you upload a video to YouTube that contains music, there's a good chance the video will have its audio muted or altered if the recording is recognized as copyrighted material. Of course, as I mentioned last episode, this isn't something that can be done by hand. There's far too much traffic for that to be realistic. Instead, it is done by AI. Now, I don't know for what reason. It's not important, but Michigan State University professor Dr. Emily Dulson tried to save a file containing simply the number 1 and nothing else to a Google Drive. It failed. According to her tweet from Sunday, Google flagged the file for copyright infringement. But most infuriating, the violation notice contains the words, quote, "A review cannot be requested for this restriction," end quote. In other words, we said so, and if we made a mistake, tough. I think this is where the narrator says, they did in fact make a mistake. Crisis Text Line is a free service that uses artificial intelligence to provide assistance to people who are suffering from emotional abuse, mental trauma, suicidal ideation, etc. Okay. So they're sending a machine to do a human's job. This is a job that clearly calls for empathy, and machines, they don't do that. Well, anyway, the same organization that provides the service also has a customer service chatbot branded Loris AI, which, unlike Crisis Text Line, is understandably for profit. Well, it seems like data from the Crisis Text Line gets shared with the for-profit service? Are you fucking kidding me? All right. Crisis Text Line claims that the data that it shares with Loris AI is fully anonymized. But can I just say that people have been successfully de-anonymizing anonymized data for at least 2 decades now? It's not that hard. It's basic detective work. And when you stick an AI into the mix, it becomes even less difficult. So, I believe that Crisis Text Line needs to rethink this. This is not the sort of information that ought to be shared. It's not clear to me how this isn't a mental health service and that this is therefore covered by HIPAA. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fongaboo and the crowd at Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to Asriel and to Thriller at Play for bringing stories to my attention. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Pwnt music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. Our Fail of the Week music is Space Reggae by Zap. And our theme music, as always, is Around Chaos by Heatseeker. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next week when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Stay safe and be well.